far as the condition of the wreckage, very tough shape. Also, the location that the wreckage is in is making our investigators' job very, very difficult.
A fatal plane crash near Togiak. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 3rd. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, military money for Fairbanks.
We don't expect to get 100% of the contracts, but Alaska should have a, let's just call it an equal shot at getting those contracts.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. More than 25,000 Alaskans are part of the Salmon Project family. Through stories, news, and a whole lot of salmon love, they're building a statewide community united by salmon. Find them on Facebook and join the conversation. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Two pilots and a passenger from Manicotic were killed when a Cessna 208 caravan crashed in the mountains northwest of Togiak yesterday afternoon. The Raven Connect flight, operated by Hagland Aviation, was en route to Togiak from Quinnahock when it lost contact and an emergency beacon was received just before 1:30 p.m. Two state troopers were the first on scene, responding from Dillingham by helicopter to the rugged, remote crash site in the Togiak Refuge. Sergeant Luis Neves, the supervisor for Bristol Bay, offered an update Sunday night.
When our troopers arrived in the area, they immediately noticed that the location was essentially a mountain, that its peak was in the clouds, and they noticed what appeared to be the wing of the aircraft.
The troopers landed and hiked up for an hour or so to the wreckage, which was fragmented and strewn across the mountain.
The aircraft apparently hit the mountain at a high altitude, probably in low visibility, is what it appears to be right now.
The passenger and two pilots died on impact, according to troopers. Some of the wreckage burned after the crash. NTSB Alaska Region Chief Clint Johnson says the two investigators who arrived on scene today are having a hard time recovering the remains and starting their own investigation.
As far as the condition of the wreckage, very tough shape. Also, the location that the wreckage is in is making our investigators' job very, very difficult.
More details about Sunday's crash, including the weather conditions, will likely come in a preliminary report from NTSB next week. Hagland and Raven, part of the same parent company, have had numerous accidents over the past several years, including the recent mid-air collision outside of Russian Mission. Johnson says NTSB takes each accident case by case.
We don't really take into account other accidents, and especially in this case, the two accidents that our office is handling right now, which is would be the midair in Russian Mission roughly a month ago, and this accident. Both of those accidents are being investigated by two separate investigators, and at this point right now, both of them are very much still in the preliminary stages.
Hagland Aviation notified the next of kin of the three men killed Sunday, but state authorities have withheld the names pending a separate notification. The family of Louis John of Manicotic, the passenger on board, was notified Sunday of his death. Lowell Thomas Jr., a former Alaska lieutenant governor, author, adventurer, glacier pilot, and son of the legendary broadcaster, has died. His daughter confirmed his death today to the Associated Press. She says her father died Saturday at his home in Anchorage, days shy of his 93rd birthday. He was born in London on October 6, 1923, to Lowell Jackson Thomas and Francis Ryan Thomas. His early childhood was spent in New York City, where his father had a nightly radio broadcast. He was a flight instructor during World War II, and flying and skiing became lifelong passions. He and his wife flew across the world and chronicled their work in articles and a book. They visited Alaska in 1958 and moved there 2 years later. Thomas was a state legislator and later lieutenant governor, a post he held from 1974 to 78. The family plans a memorial later in Anchorage. Congress last week agreed to spend more than $500 million on military construction projects in Alaska. Most are in Fairbanks to prepare Eielson Air Force Base for the arrival of F-35 aircraft. The short-term spending bill Congress passed also has $155 million for a new radar system at Clear Air Force Station and $47 million for a drone hangar at Fort Wainwright. Jim Dodson, president of the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, says the projects are a big deal for Alaska's economy, especially if the work goes to in-state contractors.
We don't expect to get, 100% of the contracts, but Alaska should have a, let's just call it an equal shot at getting those contracts.
Dodson says he's talking to the Corps of Engineers to ensure that contract set-asides and bidding preferences don't inadvertently exclude Alaskans. He says, for instance, one contract has been set aside for contractors from historically underused business zones or hub zones.
In Fairbanks, there's only a very small, like a six-block area that's hub zone qualified. Not only does a contractor have to reside in the hub zone, but 30% of his employees, or his or her employees, have to reside in that hub zone. So that pretty well means that there's no contractor in Fairbanks, Alaska, that can competitively bid on that contract.
Most of rural Alaska, though, is considered a hub zone. The appropriations bill also has about $34 million for projects at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. The city of St. George, home to 100 people, has asked the federal government to create a marine sanctuary around their island in the Bering Sea. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration officially received the application today. Mayor Pat Pletnikoff said in a recent interview the city is appealing to the government for help to preserve the rich ecosystem around their island. He says they also want more research on the seal and bird populations they rely on for subsistence.
And there's, a lot of fishing companies, large fishing vessels that we don't use, that trawl, and the factory longliners that come in near St. George Island and fish. We don't know what their total impact is.
The city has nominated waters around St. George extending out to 30 miles for sanctuary status. Pletnikoff says a sanctuary designation wouldn't automatically exclude fishing or a harbor expansion. Marine sanctuaries are established after a public process that can take years. In that way, they're different from marine monuments, which are created by presidential order. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book on the indigenous people of St. Paul Island and the world.
These are things that even today anthropologists won't acknowledge, that we have these stories about our people going very far south.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A helicopter from Air Station Sitka medevaced a Huna man to Juneau on Saturday afternoon after he was mauled by a brown bear. Alaska wildlife troopers report that Josh Dibdahl, age 30, of Huna, was hunting with a partner near Nika Bay on Chichagof Island just southwest of Huna when they heard a wolf and a sow bear charged them from the brush. The bear pinned Dibdahl, but his partner, 36-year-old Anthony Lindoff of Juneau, was able to retrieve his rifle and kill the animal. Lieutenant Greg Isbell with the Coast Guard says Dibdahl was seriously injured in the attack.
He had described that he had multiple puncture wounds, and the bear had grabbed his leg, had bit into his thigh.
Isbell says the sow had two large cubs who appeared to be about 2 years old. Even after the sow was killed, it remained a tense situation.
The hunters had to continue to shoot warning shots at the other two bears to keep them away because they kept trying to close in while they waited transportation.
The Coast Guard transported the hunters to Juneau. Dibdahl was taken to Bartlett Regional Hospital. His injuries are reported to be non-life-threatening. The incident was the fifth brown bear attack of its kind since August in the so-called ABC Islands, which comprise Game Management Hunt Unit 4. The Southeast Alaska Food Bank will be able to give away even more food than before, thanks to a new addition to its building. The food bank celebrated its increased capacity during an open house on Saturday. KTOO's Quentin Chandler has more.
Jim Wilcox Sr. sits on the Southeast Alaska Food Bank's board of directors. Last year, he was the board president. He gave that up to head the food bank's warehouse expansion.
I couldn't do both, so I turned the presidency over to one of my buddies.
He's sitting in the middle of the warehouse's new addition wearing a red cap with the food bank's logo over his white hair. He says in the last 4 years, the number of people who came to the food bank looking for food has gone up by 30% to 40%. That's why adding space onto the warehouse was paramount.
We can probably store 6 months of food worth in here right now.
And before that?
Before that, it was down in that little inn down there. And we'd be lucky if we could get a month that we could store. And that was piled clear to the ceiling.
Wilcox looks like a guy who has just finished a good meal. He lets go of a husky laugh now and then, like when his daughter from Texas walks in, or when he describes how the 2,200-square-foot expansion went from A to B in record time.
They said it could take up to a year just to get a permit from the Corps of Army Engineers. The guy came out here, walked over, dug a couple of holes. He was here about an hour and a half and come and signed the paper off and said, "You got it." And these contractors couldn't believe it.
Wilcox planned for the entire project to take a full 3 months. Some said it would take double that. He says they did it in just 52 days.
And four of them days were half days.
He gives part of the credit for the quick turnaround to a former Juno contractor who he hired out of Hoonah.
I asked him if he'd come back to Juno and be my ramrodder, because he knew all the contractors and everything too. When the guys were still here cutting the floor, and the next contractor to put all the walls up was here laying out the walls the day before they even had the floor done. So that's the way we went with the whole job.
Wilcox gives another round of praise to the businesses who helped build the space and the others that contributed. He estimates a third of them gave their services for free. The rest, the food bank covered, mostly through donations. Wilcox says it costs them less than $70 per square foot, when it should have cost about $250. The food bank's manager, Darren Adams, says right before the new and improved warehouse's open house and ribbon cutting, about 45 people came to collect close to 1,600 pounds of food. He says the new space is going to go a long way toward the food bank's day-to-day operations. There's an obvious divide between the old space and the add-on. Adams points out the sharp contrast between the two.
In years past, whenever I'd do a huge food drive or get a huge food donation, I had to make it all fit in here.
Adams remembers pallets scattered everywhere and food stacked to the ceiling.
I had to call the Nidla of Favors and ask people who normally don't store food for us to store food for us.
But hopefully not anymore. One thing the extra space can't do is give Adams more manpower. He's the only full-time employee and says the food bank is always looking for volunteers. Wilcox left the warehouse in a good mood, but not before insisting on getting a photo of a wall covered in the names of all the organizations that helped make the expansion possible. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
The fate of a state-owned public water source north of Fairbanks remains in limbo. The Fox Spring is a popular place for locals to get their drinking water, but the state wants to divest of the property to eliminate rising maintenance costs for the aging well. As KYC's Dan Bross reports, sale to a neighboring landowner is in the works while a citizens group explores other options.
Alaska Department of Transportation Northern Region spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the sale to a neighboring property owner is not a done deal in light of citizens fighting to preserve public ownership.
People have commented about the desire to keep this well open and available for public use, and we are very committed to helping that happen.
Under state law, the closest neighbor gets first right of refusal if land goes up for sale. Fox Spring neighbor Patrick Cole says he'd rather the land and spring stay stay with the state and is only interested in acquiring the property as a buffer for his own land. He emphasizes that even if the sale goes through, he wants the water source to remain accessible to the public.
My neighbors use it here, and I use it myself, you know, to get water. As long as I can work out some kind of easement that people, you know, are comfortable with, I have no problem with doing that.
The DOT resorted to private sale to Cole after the North Star Borough and other public entities declined the Fox Spring. A task force headed up by the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District is fighting to retain state ownership. Coordinator Joni Scharfenberg says the group wrote the governor's office seeking delay of the sale. She says they've been told the real estate transaction will proceed, but slowly, giving the task force time to work on public access options.
Trying to find out if this is or could be designated a historical site or a park some way.
Scharfenberg says the task force is also investigating liability issues and ways to cover maintenance costs.
People have suggested like a cooperative somehow. Other people have suggested a membership. It was very interesting, though, when one of the public task force meetings was held, people said, we don't want people who can't afford it to not be able to use it.
Scharfenberg says a similar public well in Salcha charges users 5 cents a gallon to cover maintenance. She says the task force is still trying to nail down exactly what annual expenses would be at the Fox Spring, where the well is expected to need work to maintain adequate water flow. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
October 4th is REAA Election Day. Polls are open at 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. You will be voting for REAA school board candidates. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring someone to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
A new exhibit at the Anchorage Museum brings some of the world's top artists into a single gallery for commentary on Indigenous identity. The show, Without Boundaries, opened Friday, and as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, it's an ambitious effort in more ways than one.
James Luna has been a critically acclaimed performance artist for decades, and he's readying a new piece specific to Alaska.
This is called Make America Red Again.
The piece is a wry satire of this year's presidential campaign with regular nods to the history of colonization.
We're going to build some beautiful walls. We're going to build walls around our villages. We're going to build walls around our sacred sites. Big, beautiful walls. And you know who's going to pay for it? You white people are going to pay for it. You see, because these walls are going to keep you out.
The short speech flips the rhetoric on immigration and sovereignty, and by the end, Luna tells recent migrants from other countries in this newly reclaimed Alaska that they're welcome to stick around.
You can stay and you can speak your languages freely. You can practice your religions. You're free to be cultural, because isn't that what they took away from us Indians?
Luna's work provokes, but it doesn't attack. Some of the pieces from 12 artists scattered from Alaska to Greenland take a much more assertive and critical stance about Indigenous identity and the continuing harm done to Native people. A large photo by Canadian artist Barry Pottle shows the Eskimo identification tags issued by the government starting in the 40s. A piece by the renowned American artist and educator Charlene Teeters called The Smile points to the disappointing politics of representation for Native people in the 21st century. And Edgar Heap of Birds jabs at the hypocrisies in the treatment of Native American tribes.
And then this work is it's a series called Dead Indian Stories.
On the wall are 16 red rectangles, each with 6 words scrawled from top to bottom. They read like sentence fragments, but Heap of Birds says each has its own internal logic. Can I ask about one? Sand Creek, Washita River, Sandy Hook?
Yeah, those are all sites where children were murdered. And so Sand Creek was a massacre with the Cheyenne children. Washita River was a massacre with Cheyenne children. Sandy Hook was a massacre with kindergartners in Connecticut. So, but in America, we would be more mournful of the one in Connecticut. We don't really care about the ones in Oklahoma. We don't care about the Indian deaths of children. So my point is we need to mourn all the children's deaths.
Some of the works are difficult to decipher on their own. The exhibit's catalog is more than 50 pages and includes 3 essays about themes running through the works, along with artist statements that help to understand the context.
That's why I'm the curator, so I gotta, you know, cherry pick whatever I wanted.
Sonia Keller Combs picked out the pieces, some of which already existed, while others were commissioned specifically for this exhibition. The pieces were selected to align with a series of conversations the museum's been sponsoring for more than a year. Keller Combs and others brought together artists, curators, and thinkers to discuss contemporary views on complicated subjects like the commodification of Native art, decolonization, and representation. And those conversations are the common thread running through the exhibit.
The one commonality is that these are all Indigenous or Native American or First Nations, whatever you want to call us, individuals, and they're all talking about different issues that are important to Native people.
Without Boundaries is a bold show in more ways than one. On top of having provocative individual works that may needle some patrons, it's also an ambitious attempt to put the museum front and center on international conversations about contemporary art and its intersection with Indigenous politics. Keller Combs says the process of using curated conversations as the basis for an exhibit in Alaska is unconventional in itself.
These artists are showing all over the world, the Venice Biennale, you know, like they're pushing the boundaries of what is considered, you know, the stereotype of Native American or Indigenous art, and they have strong voices and clear messages to be heard.
Without Boundaries is at the Anchorage Museum through February. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Ilarian Larry Merkuliev is an Aleut educator and has traveled the world working with Indigenous people. He's written a book called Wisdom Keeper that chronicles the stories of his people of the Pribilof Islands and messages from Native elders in Alaska and from other countries. It also highlights the science and technology of his seagoing people, known more commonly as Larry. He says even his name, Ilarian, was part of colonization and the imposed religion that Native people had to deal with.
You were given a choice to join the church, in which case you'll be treated like a civilized human being, or you choose not to and then get treated badly. And so most people joined the church. And to join the church, you had to take a Russian name. That's something that most people don't know.
Your book has chapters dealing with slavery and genocide, education, both in the academic sense and articulations about what instructions elders give. How did you decide how to map all of this out? It's a lot of history. How did you go about that?
I didn't. I mean, I just sat down and would write, and that's the way it was. And I just would write what I felt each day and didn't have a roadmap at all. And that's probably why it took me 20 years to do it.
The title Wisdom Keeper, I was curious about that. Wisdom's value is in being shared. So how do you both stay clear about retaining the wisdom of the past, which is so important, but making those lessons relevant for younger people today and go about sharing it?
Well, I'm living the legacy of my name, my traditional name, Kuyuch, which I was given by the last Kuyuch that was left alive at the time, and I was 4 years old. He gave me that name, and so we called each other Kuyuch. Kuyuch means a bridge or a messenger from ancient times into modern. And now I'm living the legacy of my name. It's quite interesting the way that, you know, I tell the story in the books about how this evolved for me. And so it's really about the wisdom of the elders through the lens of my life.
You wrote and just mentioned also that after 20 years of writing a lot of these stories, that it was finally time to tell them. Why is now the time?
There are a couple reasons that I wrote it. One is that my friends kept telling me, you've got to write these stories down. And finally, I decided to do that. The second thing is that I work with elders from all over the world. And they are speaking with an urgency that I haven't ever heard them talk. And they want their messages to get out. And any way that we can. I mean, normally, we don't single ourselves out, like writing a book, for example, with my picture on it and a wisdom keeper. I mean, this title was picked up or made up by the publisher. It wasn't what I had recommended. The urgency that they speak of is about this time that we have to change our consciousness. And that consciousness is mind-centered as a center of intelligence. When in a traditional viewpoint, in all indigenous peoples, it's the entire makeup of the body that that we use. We use all of our senses. We use our gut feel, our heart sense, intuition. All of these things are operating, but they are stopped from being their full aspect of what they are because we're so focused on the mind. And so the elders say we must drop out of the head and go into the heart.
The Unungan people's history is incredibly rich in a technological perspective. They are and have been for generations highly skilled seagoing people and the builders of vessels for the sea. How did you write about that in your book?
Yeah, that's very true. The kayak, the Smithsonian and London University were trying to figure out what's the best high seas kayak in the world because they were funding an expedition that would go by kayak. And they discovered that, lo and behold, Unungan had the best high seas kayak in the world. And we traveled to South America, the South Pacific, across to all parts of Russia and to Point Barrow. And these are things that even today anthropologists won't acknowledge, that we have these stories about our people going very far south.
Ilarion Merkuliev grew up on St. Paul Island. His new book is called Wisdom Keeper. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.